Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Later in the show, we will discuss yesterday's deadly shooting at the Garlic Festival in Gilroy, California. But first, we are going to start with our regularly scheduled programming. We're going to talk today about the growing recycling crisis in the United States. Historically, the U.S. has shipped about half of recyclable waste, including plastic, glass, and paper, to China and other countries. For many years, China accepted 40% of recycled trash from the United States. But last year, China decided to change its policy and stop accepting America's waste. They said it was contaminated with food and other junk, rendering them unrecyclable. Many argue that sending our recycling to China distorts our view about our recycling policies and how and what we recycle, especially plastic. In 2016, 760 million tons of our scrap plastic went to China, but that figure plummeted by a whopping 95% last year after China tightened its standards. It's important to add that Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, and most recently India have also banned scrap plastic imports since last fall. So what has been the impact of China's policy on recycling programs across the U.S.? Well, according to a Guardian investigation, cities are no longer recycling many types of plastic dropped into recycling bins. Instead, they're being landfilled, burned, or stockpiled. So what can be done about this? Today, we're joined by Mark Murray, Executive Director of Californians Against Waste, a nonprofit that works to reduce pollution, reduce waste, increase recycling, and protect our environment. And Mark Murray joins us on the phone from his office in Sacramento. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. Kate O'Neill is professor in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. She's the author of the new book, Waste, and she joins us from the studios of Studio Media Recording Company in Chicago. Hi, Professor O'Neill. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Last year, we spoke with you, Kate, about what it meant for China not to take our recyclable trash. And it's been a little more than a year, and we see many headlines about how the change in China's policy has really created a crisis for many cities across the country. So before we talk about the impacts, can you just go over, give us a little history? Why did China agree to accept so much of our waste in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been, China's been accepting plastic waste, or had accepted plastic waste and other scrap from the U.S. Since the early years of the century, really dating back to its joining the WTO and the huge growth spurt it put on in the 2000s. Now, much of that scrap, probably most of it certainly by weight, has been what we think of as good scrap, aluminum, copper, steel, iron, other kinds of materials that are just simply, you know, transformed back into what they were and reused indefinitely. But a lot of that scrap turned out to be plastic and paper, which is a lot harder to recycle. China took it in because they needed those inputs for their manufacturing. They did not have the capacity to produce their own virgin plastics, so they imported it from overseas, nor did they produce enough of their own scrap. So this became a really booming industry, and it was made easier by the fact that China exports so much to us in these container ships that rather than sending the container ships home empty, you could send them home filled with scrap, and that this was very cheap in terms of transportation. So it became really quite a boom industry for our recycling companies and waste management companies in this country.
WBUR had a great piece about this, and they report that it's not just the United States. Some 70% of the world's plastic waste went to China, which is 7 million tons a year, and a number of Chinese millionaires were minted as recycling businesses started and blossomed.
Yeah, yeah. This was a practice undertaken by most OECD countries. Some have been more effective than others. Australia and the UK, I could name in particular, is facing this crisis. So, yes, it was a global business. And you do see some of these large Chinese companies are doing very well out of it. And I don't know if we'll get to it later, but that has some interesting implications for dealing with the current crisis in the U.S.
And what would you add on that, Mark? WBUR also quotes a few people saying that there was a huge problem with this in China, obviously. Steve Wilson is an environmental activist, and he said that the plastic would get dumped in neighboring communities, and the only way to get rid of it is to openly burn it, which affects the air, the water, and the land in China. So can you also talk about that aspect of this?
Yeah, I think we're sort of getting increasingly aware about the environmental impacts of plastic, especially through improper disposal. Now, it's not totally the case that all of it was dumped or burned in China. Their usage of it was significantly higher than our usage of recycling here, percentage-wise. However, I think that one of the critical issues there was who was doing that recycling anyway, and that was often informal workers working under very difficult and dangerous conditions. So those problems were definitely very clear, and since we saw a massive diversion of plastics to Malaysia, Indonesia, and other Southeast Asian countries who really don't have as much capacity or even demand for such plastic, we saw even greater consequences in terms of that plastic piling up.
And Mark, what would you add?
Yeah, I think Kate made the point earlier that China saw within our waste streams, you know, good recyclables and bad recyclables. And even in the world of paper and plastic, there were materials that were truly recyclable and materials that were not. And China, using this very cheap labor and really a non-existent regulatory framework to deal with the material that wasn't recyclable, they enabled the United States and other developing countries to send just everything, all mixed plastic, a bunch of mixed paper that had contaminants, that had plastic coating, that had plastics that were never recyclable. But they were willing to do that because they had this cheap labor, and they effectively had, you know, for these independent operations, these rogue operations, had zero costs of disposal, but because, as you say, they were burning the 3-7 plastics, they were dumping them in rivers and ultimately pushing out into the bay and into the ocean. So that same willingness to take all of the plastic confused American collectors and recyclers. We thought that this material was actually getting recycled when, in fact, it never was getting recycled. And so, to some extent, yes, this is a crisis, but it's also a real wake-up call in terms of sending a message that we could have used a decade ago about some plastic is recyclable, a lot of plastic is not. Paper is very recyclable if we keep it clean, if it doesn't have plastic coating. And so we needed to get that signal, and in a kind of a dramatic way, we are now finally getting that message about what is recyclable and what is not.
Hmm. And Mark, I'm guessing that a lot of people had no idea that so much of our waste was going to China and other countries until they stopped accepting it. So do you know, for example, let's take San Francisco. You know, I always read during the holidays when people are receiving packages, and we'll talk about this later in the show, that the local recycling centers are so overwhelmed just with the cardboard alone. Do you know how cities make decisions? Who decides what to send, or when China was still accepting the waste, who decided how much to send to China?
Yeah, it's not really a recycling program making a decision about where to send it. It's really economics driving that. And as Kate pointed out, you had empty shipping containers going from, you know, the Port of Oakland to China, and it was next to nothing to fill those containers with as much mixed paper and as much mixed plastic as we could, as these recycling programs could. That ended up being a cheaper option than shipping the material by land to a paper recycler in Oregon or Washington or Canada, or shipping the plastic even to a recycler in Southern California. It was cheaper to put it in a shipping container and send it to China than it was to send it to the legitimate plastic recycling operations that we have here in California.
Can you both talk to us about the scope and the scale of this problem? According to Fast Company, 165 billion packages are shipped in the United States every year. That's 165 billion packages. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around that. And think about all the plastic that comes in those boxes. And then there's bottled water. According to EcoWatch, in the United States, Americans go through about 50 billion plastic water bottles every single year. So how would you describe the scope of this problem, Kate, when you just look at how much people consume and use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I personally find it overwhelming. Probably lived through this massive growth in plastic water bottles, straws, etc. And I think that we really have been outsourcing and hiding the scope of this issue. I mean, I teach and I work in this area, so I know people have been trying to yell about these issues for years, and I think it's only now we're really starting to take single-use consumer plastics very seriously. So I really don't think we have viable solutions. And packaging, again, is it's a very clear issue of mixed waste. Packaging does not have to be mixed waste. As Mark said, clean paper and cardboard that's uncontaminated by tape and so on is very recyclable. But what we actually throw out and what we actually, or sometimes what we try to recycle, is not actually recyclable. It's either contaminated or it's got tape or other things on it. And it's something that really we have to talk to the major shippers about as well.
What would you add, Mark? How do you describe the scope of this problem?
I guess I would add to that is that I think that we got in this predicament for two reasons. One is that as we have, as the United States has kind of gone on this binge of fracking and production of and refining of natural gas and petroleum, we have made the cost of producing plastic cheaper and cheaper. Plastic is a byproduct of that natural gas and petroleum refining process. And plastic is cheaper today than it was a decade ago. And so it's very inexpensive for manufacturers to create all kinds of plastic packaging and plastic trinkets. You know, we're seeing serving sizes of, you know, the way that our products at the grocery store are delivered to us in, you know, more and more single-serve units wrapped in plastic, packaged in plastic, because the plastic is so cheap. One of the reasons the plastic is so cheap, in addition to the raw material cost, is that we've never asked the brand owners, we've never asked the produce companies or the beverage companies to internalize the cost of end-of-life management. And so part of the thing that I think we need to do is we need to be more honest about what is the cost of plastic and have the manufacturers internalize that cost of plastic so that the economy will recognize that this isn't the cheap material that we think it is. Similarly, I think as consumers, we were provided effectively misinformation from our recycling programs, our collection programs. Mm-hmm. We were led to believe that we could just throw all of this plastic into our bins, and so we didn't worry about purchasing more and more of this plastic packaging because we were under the false impression that the material could go in our bin and ultimately get recycled by someone somewhere. And those two signals, I think, have caused this really eruption in the volume of plastic packaging. And I think the answer is a combination of restrictions on the types and quantities of plastic that we're generating, but also getting the price right so that the manufacturers are forced to internalize this cost so that they're less likely to just inundate us with all of this plastic packaging.
That is Mark Murray. Go ahead, Kate.
Oh, if I could just add to that, I think that from what I've heard, particularly recently, and Mark will know more about this than I do, that with the fracking boom very recently, there's been a plummet in the cost of producing virgin plastic. And that is really a central challenge now to a lot of initiatives to create a circular economy, to increase our use of recycled plastic. And that might also challenge a strategy that a lot of people have been using, which is to actually target Coke and Unilever and those big producers to start changing what they put into their packaging using and bottles using more recycled material. So we've got these ongoing challenges across the whole chain of from plastic production, fossil fuel extraction indeed, through to recycling and disposal. And this chain itself is very complex and keeps changing, and I think is very challenging for anyone looking for a solution to this problem.
Kate O'Neill is professor in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley and is author of the new book, Waste. We're also joined by Mark Murray, executive director of Californians Against Waste. It's a nonprofit that works to reduce pollution, reduce waste, increase recycling, and protect the planet. And today we are talking about the growing recycling crisis in the United States. Later in the show, we will discuss yesterday's tragic shooting at the Garlic Festival in Gilroy. If you have any questions or comments right now specifically about recycling, we've been reporting on this, but honestly, when the Chinese government decided to stop accepting all of this waste, we just didn't know that the U.S. was exporting about 700,000 tons a year of recycling waste to China alone. And so now a lot of cities are really struggling to figure out what to do with all of this waste, especially plastic. So what questions or comments do you have for our guests? And then what are your thoughts just about how things have changed so much? We did a show about Prime, Amazon Prime, and we learned that last year, just on that one day, shoppers purchased more than 100 million products on one day alone. Well, what happens to all that plastic and packaging? So as you're learning more about this crisis, are you maybe changing how you shop online? And then when it comes to holding companies accountable, what would you like to see? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Our recycling system is pretty complex. Different cities have their own programs. Kate, what is the current U.S. policy toward recycling?
Right. Rose, I'm glad that you asked that question, because I think that's something that, if you're following this issue, is front and center. Historically, the United States, unlike Europe and other countries, has just simply been very local when it comes to recycling policy at city, county, state level. That's where decisions about what's going to be recycled and how have been made. And that means that in response to a crisis such as this one, there's really no national platform in which to take a stand. The only real federal policy around waste has to do with hazardous waste, Superfund, and the EPA also provides a lot of information about municipal solid waste management, but that's really it. So in the last couple of months, there have been some efforts in congressional appropriations bills and also a separate bill put forward by, I think, a couple of our more progressive senators to create some kind of a national legislative framework for both plastics and for recycling, which would work at least to kind of harmonize standards, to create things like labeling that would be used across country to explain to people as they travel, as they're in different places, to give them a common understanding of what is recyclable and what isn't. So that is starting to move forward, but the U.S. really does lag behind Europe and other countries in creating this sort of integrated waste policy, and also in creating national federal level investment in improving recycling facilities and capacities. We're seeing that happen again from very local levels. California and other states are really putting some money into improving their recycling capacities and sorting capacities. But I think without some federal backing, that's not going to be as effective as it could be over the longer term.
And Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and other lawmakers introduced the Zero Waste Act last Thursday. According to the the MinnPost. It's a bill that seeks to end use of toxic landfills. It's intended to create a federal grant program to aid local cities in investing in zero waste initiatives. Mark, before we get to calls, what would you add about policies and what's missing?
Well, I think, I'm not going to hold my breath on the federal government taking this issue on. As Kate pointed out, the federal government has really never engaged in solid waste management and recycling policy. It has been left to the states. And so we're very focused on California, and we think that California can really and is in the process, really, of advancing model policies for reducing and recycling packaging waste with a real focus on plastic. And we've already seen some results from California's efforts in terms of increasing the utilization of recycled material in products. So we're going to continue to push in that front. One example I can point to is that you think of PET recycling, which is the water bottles and the soft drink bottles, and you know, there was a time when 90% of those bottles that we were collecting for recycling in California were being shipped overseas, mostly to China, turned into polyester and other materials. California policy has been to use both carrots and sticks to move that material back into the packaging, back into beverage container packaging, back into grocery packaging, closing the loop. And today, with PET at least, with the soft drink bottles and the bottled water containers, we're at a 75% recycling rate, and 90% of that material is staying here in California, both because the manufacturers, the soft drink industry, is effectively being economically compelled to do that, but also because of incentives. Using unredeemed money from the beverage container recycling law has created these businesses in California that can utilize the material and turn it back into the bottles. So there is a way to do this. It takes some effort. It takes a great deal of producer responsibility, and we need to build on those models. And I think that California is even this summer is working on policies to do that.
Mark, you mentioned that the federal government has always just pushed this problem and this crisis to the states. Why is that? Can you give us some background on that?
I think that partly it was pointed out that the federal government has focused on hazardous waste, and the federal government still focuses on the regulation of landfills. And so there is an environmental protection framework that deals with protecting public health and the environment on the disposal side of things. But I think that the world of recycling is so different even from the East Coast to the West Coast in terms of the materials that we do recycle. I mean, even today, despite the crisis with regard to plastic and plastic-contaminated paper, we're seeing record recycling levels for metals and clean paper and glass. So the federal government didn't identify this as really being a problem because a lot of recycling was taking care of itself domestically. And, the plastic was kind of out of sight, out of mind in terms of being shipped overseas. So it really wasn't until the last, 4 or 5 years that this has kind of become an emerging crisis. And to be quite honest, we haven't really had the federal government in place that really cares too much about those kinds of issues.
And if I might add to what Mark just said, which a great California example, I think that it just shows a fundamental misthinking at the federal level that waste is just something that we throw away and never think of again. When clearly, when you look at the world of recycling across this country and across the world, you're dealing with products that are reused, turned back into things of value, which require very different tools and understandings to actually make work really, really well.
Today we're speaking about the growing recycling crisis in the United States with Kate O'Neill, professor in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley. She's author of the new book Waste, and Mark Murray is executive director of Californians Against Waste. And let's hear from David in Oakland. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Two thoughts. One, there are a lot of items of merchandise that come into this country prepackaged in cardboard with plastics that we wouldn't like used as packaging. For instance, the white styrofoam stuff, for which there is no real reuse, as I understand it. Seems to me, in terms of China, a polite note to them saying, we're going to collect all of the stuff that we can't recycle and send it back to you. And if you don't like it, we'll just stop bringing in your merchandise. Now, that's the crazy side of it. The easier side of it is, if you go to the big box stores to buy certain kinds of electrical products, I work as an electrician, they are incredibly hard packaged in plastic one by one because of the pilferage issue. Same product over at an electrical distributor is in a lightweight cardboard box that is obviously recyclable. Seems to me the big box stores should be, as it were, taxed on that kind of packaging. They don't have to do it that way. They force the manufacturers to ship the things to them that way. That's a case where, you know, California could say, no, I'm sorry, we don't allow this sort of packaging. You send it in a different format if you're shipping it into the state. We do that with other stuff. And both of these are examples of where we really need to sort of tamp down on what we accept at the cash register or the UPS delivery in the way of junk that never should have been used in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Kate, what are your comments on that?
Yes, I would fully agree with the caller. I believe that, for example, Europe, as I mentioned, is developing full what's called extended producer responsibility laws, where producers themselves are responsible for taking back this packaging, creating incentives for reducing its use. So I think many activist groups and some policymakers are looking at how that can be applied. And I believe Mark is, in his example of the awesome work California is doing, is demonstrating some of that thinking. So that is definitely a challenge and seems something that for those of us who have to struggle with opening those plastic containers is also a nuisance. So that is, I think, something important to do. Other ways, thinking back to the styrofoam pellets, that's a huge issue. And one of the ways that I see it being tackled, that sort of packaging, is through procurers. Like, I work for the University of California, one of the state's largest employers, and it's developing policies of saying, no, we're not accepting that. And when a huge, huge buyer like that says, no, we're not taking this, that has ripple effects across the entire market.
Mark, what would you add?
Yeah, I would simply add that I think that, you know, David's suggestion maybe 4 years ago would have seemed crazy. But in fact, I think that this is exactly where we need to go. That is effectively, he's effectively described Senator Ben Allen's SB 54 and Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez's AB 1080. And these policies set what we call rates and dates by which plastics, each type of plastic will have to demonstrate its recyclability. And demonstrating its recyclability means there has to be an end user, there has to be a buyer. It's not just, can I put it in my recycling bin? Can I ship it to China and some mystery box over there will take care of it? This legislation will say, as a condition of sale in the state of California, demonstration of 20% recycling by 2024. And if a material like polystyrene, like polyvinyl chlorides, these other 3-7 plastics, if they can't demonstrate true recyclability, then they will be phased out of the marketplace. So, again, may have seemed crazy a few years ago, but I think that policymakers are talking about exactly that type of approach here in California.
Well, thank you for calling in, David. Let's go next to Dory in San Francisco. Hi, Dory.
Hey, good morning, Rose, and Mark and Kate. I have a couple of points and a couple of questions. First of all, I think everyone just needs to remind themselves, you can drink San Francisco water and it's perfectly fine. There's no need to buy bottled you know, plastic water, you know, buy a thermos and fill it up and take it where you want to go. Or at least buy glass bottled water if you really feel you need to. I also think, as much as I even own a Trader Joe's T-shirt, I like Trader Joe's, but I can't stand their packaging. It drives me crazy. And it costs more, but it's such a more environmentally responsible model, you know, a rainbow grocery where, you know, you can bring your own plastic bag, you take it out of, you know, the bin, out of, you know, the nuts, you know, go right into your bag and you buy it, instead of just buying things that are made in plastic bags at Trader Joe's, whether it be nuts, their vegetables, on and on. They're trying to be better in that department. They have some compostable bags now, but overall they do a dreadful, dreadful job, and they really have woken up way too late to the recycling crisis. So, you know, those are a couple of points. In terms of questions, one thing is I have a ton of what I call bubble envelopes because, Rose, as you know, I have a music program tangent, so I get CDs in the mail every day in a bubble envelope. It's not recyclable. You'd have to separate the plastic from the paper. I'm just wondering if anyone knows in the Bay Area where it can be reused, not recycled, but actually reused, and I'll bring them to any place that, you know, would reuse them, or at least make them available for reuse. The other questions I have has to do with Recology says that they, you know, now they take plastic bags, and I'm wondering, do any of your guests know what they do with the plastic bags? Do they actually recycle them? Are they stocked? Were they the ones that were going to China? Now they don't know what to do with them. So I wonder what happens to those plastic bags that recycle, that Recology picks up. And lastly, the coating on the plastic, like whether it says number 6, number 5, whatever it says, I was under the impression number 6 is not recyclable. Can you update me on the numbers that are valid and the numbers that are not?
Okay, thank you, Dory. Kate, can you answer some of those questions?
Oh yeah. Let's have a go. I don't know about the bubble wrap envelopes, and if any listener knows, please email in or let us know via social media. I have the same problem. Probably not quite to the same scale. In terms of the plastic numbers on the bottles and the wherever we're seeing them, I think those are something that we really need to examine. The general rule is that only ones and twos are truly recyclable, and then if they're clean. And actually now on the UC Berkeley campus, you see ones and twos on the recycling bins, and then it says send the other plastics to landfill in the landfill bins. So that is sad, but it does avoid contamination and increases recycling of what is recyclable. So changing those numbers, or at least changing that little recycling sign around, it seems to me a priority that I haven't really heard talked about. So that's a problem there. The plastic bags, Mark might know more than me, but they have been problematic for a lot of recyclers, because if they get tangled up mixed up with the rest of the plastic, they can tangle up the sorting facilities and shut them down. So I think the shift towards collecting plastic bags is also a push towards take them all to the same place and keep them together, hopefully for only as long as they exist. Hopefully that won't be much longer for single-use plastic bags. Again, how they are reused, their plastic number 4, they have some ways of being turned into, I think, some clothing and so on. But again, Mark might know more than I do about that specific question.
Well, I just found an answer to the bubble wrap question. I think this is important because I'm sure a lot of people have these envelopes with the bubble wrap. According to Live Green Recycle Bank, you cannot recycle the bubble wrap envelopes. You have to tear them apart, recycle the paper, and then there is a place where you can either drop off or send in the bubble wrap itself. And we will put a link to this at yourcallradio.org. Mark, what about the bigger question, though? Really educating citizens about this show. I was reading that the top two items that Amazon sells are bananas and paper towels. And I mean, we'll do another show about just all the issues around that, the transportation and all of that. But that is wrapped in plastic. The bananas, as Jory said, all the stuff at Trader Joe's is wrapped in plastic. So what about really educating citizens to then put pressure on the corporations to change how they do business?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, frankly, this wishful collection system that we have at curbside has miseducated us. And I think that we've got to, you know, maybe that's where we need to start. Because, I mean, we can do all of the public service education that we want, but if the curbside recycling program is still lulling people into believing that the plastic, the 3-7 plastics or the plastic film is recyclable, then folks are not going to worry about continuing to accept it or purchase it. So one example is the Recology example. Recology is certainly one of the best recycling companies in the country in terms of their the spectrum of recycling, of collection service they offer. They're a leader in organic composting, again, in the nation. However, on a different radio program with somebody from Recology, they said, yes, we're continuing to tell people to put the plastic film, tie it up in a bag, and so it's a ball of plastic film, and we're trying to find someone that will recycle it, but at the moment, the material is getting thrown away. So Recology is wishfully hoping that there will be a new market emerging for the plastic film, but at this moment, at least, you know, a month ago on a different radio program, the representative said, we are having to throw it away. So some material is technically recyclable. So the plastic film, the polyethylene, it can be turned into agricultural film. It can be turned into drip tape at in agriculture. But right now, Recology, who's the best at this, can't find an end-use market. The 3-7 plastics, the little code on the bottom. Number 5 plastic, polypropylene, technically recyclable if we can ship it to Alabama. But it's not really happening in California. It's too expensive to do. And so, but some curbside programs are wishfully hoping that that recycling opportunity is right around the corner, so we don't want to confuse the public, so we're going to keep telling them to put it in the bin, even though at the moment we're throwing it away. And I think that this misinformation to consumers at the curbside bin is part of what's contributing to this notion that, I can put it in my bin, it must be okay to accept this packaging at Trader Joe's. Maybe if I knew that none of this crap was recyclable, I would stop buying it. I would tell my grocery store, I don't want this anymore.
Well, as we said, this is a growing crisis. Just a few examples about what's happening across the country. Douglas County, Oregon, stopped accepting plastic and glass recycling this summer. Phoenix City, Alabama, curtailed its recycling program. Philadelphia is picking up recyclables, but it's burning as much as half of the materials. In small communities from Hancock, Maine to Kingsport, Tennessee, they're not able to support the higher cost of their recycling problems, and they're paying a lot more for it. So, Kate, I mean, we say that this is a growing crisis, but it feels like it's a crisis right now when you look at what's happening in certain cities across the country.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but I would also say that it's an ongoing situation where a lot of the recyclers themselves are really seeing this as an opportunity. It's one that is taking a while to unfold, but to really have this opportunity to tighten up programs and do more public education, create different facilities. So you hear a lot of excitement, but I think that there is also this flip side of, well, how do we actually have these recycling programs when we used to be able to pay for them through selling the plastic and paper to China? And so now you're also seeing quite a lot of price increases. Waste Management is one of the biggest waste company in this country, and it is renegotiating its longer-term contracts with a lot of cities, and of course that is passing on huge bump-ups in terms of what the cities and therefore consumers pay. So there are a lot of issues there. Glass is often not collected in a lot of localities now. And some states that were implementing recycling programs are now also pulling back on those considerably. So you're definitely seeing very much a shifting landscape that I think can only really be addressed, well, it can mostly be addressed at source by reducing the waste stream. But at the moment, we are not having a lot of success with that.
And a final question to both of you. What will it take to really take on these powerful industries? I mean, at the end of the day, that's one of the big problems here. The Intercept's Sharon Lerner has a piece called Waste Only, How the Plastics Industry is Fighting to Keep Polluting the World. And she reports on the Plastics Industry Association and all the lobbying they do. They include Chevron, Exxon, DuPont, Novolex. They all profit hugely from the production of plastics. So what about that aspect of it, Mark?
Yeah, so we're engaged in the battle right now in Sacramento in terms of organizing support for legislation to make the manufacturers responsible for reducing and recycling this packaging waste. And the legislature will wrap up its legislative session the second week in September. So we've basically got 6 weeks to make something happen. There's we're facing tremendous financial lobbyists and PR companies on behalf of the plastics industry. On August 21st in Sacramento, there is a Plastics Day of Action that we're organizing where folks can come to Sacramento and demand change. Folks can find out about this at our website, cawrecycles.org. But it's really the public is going to have to stand up and say enough is enough. And the policies are moving through the legislature, but in order to get them over the top, in order to get the governor to engage and sign this legislation, the public is going to have to say that we want to see a change. We want to reduce the amount of plastic pollution. And so folks are going to have to get involved.
And what would you add, Kate?
I would add to the amazing work that California is doing is also the need to think globally. One of the things that we've seen in campaigns like this before, you think about campaigns against cigarettes. Well, you saw the large companies saying, okay, well, the U.S., let's they're starting to regulate tobacco. So let's shift to developing countries. And that's where we're going to build our future markets. And I think we've seen in recent months, we've seen a big effort on the part of the Southeast Asian nations that were being overwhelmed by plastics to say, no, we're not taking this in. And in fact, sending it back. And that I think has been a very powerful signal that is enabling global action to deal with plastics as well. Now, how well that's going to work over the longer term is hard to predict. But I think as well as thinking at the California level, you do have to say, well, how are we going to do this at a global political level so we can help prevent these shifts, this outsourcing, this distancing of the risks that we've been facing to communities that don't have the level of political mobilization that we do have here. So we need to be looking at both local and global developments in tandem.
Well, anytime we do a show about recycling, we get so many phone calls and emails, and I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them, but we will continue to have these important conversations. Kate O'Neill is professor in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley, and she's author of the new book, Waste. Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you. We'd love to have you back. And Mark Murray is executive director of Californians Against Waste. Mark, thank you. Thanks for your work, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And you can find more information about recycling at yourcallradio.org. We just got a good tip from a listener who says that she gives her padded envelopes to the public library, and then they reuse them to send books to other branches. Thank you for that recommendation, Sylvie. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about the latest deadly shooting. This one happened yesterday at the Gilroy Garlic Festival in Northern California. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're going to spend the last 10 minutes of the show talking about yesterday's deadly shooting at the Gilroy Garlic Festival in Northern California. For those who are not in the area, it's about an hour and a half south of San Francisco. This is a three-day yearly festival where 100,000 people turn out to celebrate the area's garlic, really. All kinds of events and things happen there. And we got word yesterday that there was a horrific shooting. And at this point, we know that three people were killed, including 6-year-old Stephen Luciano Romero of San Jose, and 15 were wounded. And we now know that the gunman was a 19-year-old man. Joining us to talk about this is Jessica Blitchock, a mom, wife, lawyer, and leader with the California chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Jessica lives in San Jose and helped start the local group of Moms Demand Action in San Jose. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Jessica. I just feel like these horrific shootings are happening so often. And when they do, you know, we all get together and say, should we change the show and talk about this? And, you know, this was so close to home. We thought we've got to have someone on just to talk about it. And I just wonder, you all tweet about this on a daily basis. I mean, there was another shooting at a festival in Brooklyn on Saturday night. Sometimes I cannot keep up with your Twitter feed.
Yes.
At this point, what does the conversation need to sound like?
Well, in this situation, specifically talking about Gilroy, details are still emerging. But the reality is that there is no one law that is going to stop every shooting, whether it's in California or another state. But it is true that states with stronger gun laws see lower rates of gun violence. And it's really important that we do something as a nation to address the patchwork of states' laws that exist across our country.
Mm. What do you think about the conversation that happens after these shootings? What is missing from these conversations in the media?
Well, I think we need to address how much this is a uniquely American problem. Mm. After events of this kind, we hear that so many different things are blamed, mental health, video games, but we know that most other first world countries deal with the same problems. They play video games, they have the same rates of mental health problems, but they don't have a gun violence problem, and that's because the real problem here in America is access to guns, and we need to address access to guns. Luckily, in California, our lawmakers are taking this seriously and continuing to strengthen our gun laws, but there's always more to be done.
Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand, who was on our show about a month or so ago, she tweeted, "There are angry white men in every country in this world, but only in the United States do they have easy access to guns."
Yes, it's true. What we need to do is address the background check problem. There needs to be a background check on the sale of every gun across our country. Half of all Americans still live in states where a convicted felon, a domestic abuser, or even a fugitive can skip a background check and get access to a gun.
Where is the conversation on the assault weapons ban? Because CNN reports that the weapon was an AK-47 style rifle, and it was purchased legally by the 19-year-old in Nevada on July 9th.
I don't know. I can't answer specifically where the conversation is on the assault weapons ban, but I do know that here in California, we passed a law that went into effect at the beginning of this year that raised the age to buy all firearms to the age of 21. But so I know that we're doing something here in California to make sure that individuals under the age of 21 don't get their hands on a firearm.
It's factual to say that in order to pass strong gun legislation at the federal level, you're going to need a Democratic president with a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House. Would you agree with that?
I won't say that the gun violence issue is a partisan issue. We need gun sense candidates. We need people who will vote for common sense gun laws to be elected into office, and those can be Republicans, they can be Democrats, they can be independents. They don't need to be Democrats. They need to be people who believe in common sense gun laws and will vote for them.
Well, with this current group of Republicans, we're not getting strong gun legislation. And I just wonder, from the Democrats that you're hearing from, there's going to be another presidential debate tomorrow at 5 Pacific and then on Wednesday at 5 Pacific. What are your thoughts? I mean, Shannon said, you know what? They all have plans, which did not happen during, say, 8 years ago. What are your thoughts about some of the plans you've been hearing about? What's missing from the plans, if anything?
I think the plans need to include education across the country for so that people understand that this is a uniquely American problem. People need to understand that 100 Americans a day die as a result of gun violence. They need to understand that two-thirds of those people are dying as a result of suicide, that while the attention goes to these mass shootings, that's what the media pays attention to, that it's really the daily gun violence that's taking a toll and taking the most lives in this country, and that's what we need to address.
100 Americans are killed with guns every single day in this country.
Yes.
And Shannon, I want to do a separate show about these young men. I understand, you know, your point and concern that these young men who shoot get a lot of attention. But I was just thinking, you know, when I was growing up, we may have gotten a fake bomb threat to high school, but this is not something we ever even thought about. It just didn't happen. And I wonder, what do you think the conversation needs to sound like about these young men, in this case, 19, who, according to onlookers, he walked in and just started randomly shooting?
Well, we don't know in this situation whether there were any signs that this individual was going to take this type of action or commit this type of act. But I will tell you that something that needs to happen is that the community needs to be educated about gun violence restraining order laws. Here in California, we have a gun violence restraining order law. And what that does is allow family and household members or law enforcement to seek a civil order with a judge to have firearms temporarily removed from someone who has indicated that they are a risk to the community or even to themselves. This is something that the community doesn't know about, and that we are working very hard at the San Jose Group of Moms Demand Action and with the Santa Clara County District Attorney to educate the community that if you hear something or see something, you need to say something. So that would go to any individual who has indicated that they are a threat to our community or to themselves. You need to call law enforcement, because there is something that we can do. We can have the firearms temporarily removed, and we can keep our communities and our families safe.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. I wish I didn't have to be here on this call.
I agree with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for your work. Jessica Blitchok is a mom, lawyer, and leader with the California chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar.